Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio. My name is Keith, amateur radio operator W0NX. The following articles are from the February 2024 The Spectrum Monitor, and we'll begin by continuing the article Radio 101 by Ken Reitz, KS4ACR, Technician Class Voice Privileges on the 10-meter band. The Radiodity QT40 is the cheapest one I've found. According to the FCC database, as of January 1st, there are a total of 374,746 technician class amateur radio operators in the U.S. Each is qualified to operate with voice privileges on the 10-meter band from 28.3 to 28.5 megahertz with up to 200 watts. That's 200 kilohertz of bandwidth to chase DX, work on WAS, DXCC, engage in contesting, and in general, enjoy HF voice activities like other licensed hams in the world who also have voice privileges on 10 meters. That's great, but many of those 374,746 don't have the $1,000 to shell out for a new all-band, all-mode transceiver, or even $500 to pay for a used rig. That's the value of the Radiodity QT40 or the Anytone ARES-II. It's important to know your place as a technician. The QT40 offers AM mode, 29 to 29.2 MHz, and FM mode, 29.6 MHz simplex, and FM repeater inputs and output on either side of the calling frequency from 29.52 to 29.7 megahertz, as well as the 10-meter slow scan TV calling frequency, 28.68 megahertz, all of which are out of band for technician class, but give you an incentive to work toward your general class ticket. Know your technician class privileges by looking them up at arrl.org. The Long March of Chinese Amateur Radio. The world has benefited from China's position as the world's electronics manufacturer. Innovative products at rock-bottom prices have been the norm for many years. Capitalism with Chinese characteristics aptly describes the current situation that has brought these benefits to the world, certainly in the field of electronic products. A country protected from anti-government criticism by its Great Firewall is also the global distributor of inexpensive but decently made AM/FM radios, shortwave radios, scanners, VHF, UHF, and HF gear, as well as our TV sets, smartphones, routers, computers, you name it. As may be expected, China's relationship with amateur radio has been rocky. According to an article in QST from 2008, before the Communist Revolution of 1949, there were about 400 individual amateurs within China, mostly foreigners, missionaries, educators, and others. After the revolution, amateur radio was forbidden until 1958, when the first call sign was issued, BY1PK. From 1966 to 1976, during Chairman Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution, amateur radio was again banned. It wasn't until 1982 that the BY1PK call sign was once again on the air. But, as was typical of Soviet bloc countries, the station was under the strict control of the Communist Party. It wasn't until 2 years later in 1984 that China joined the International Amateur Radio Union, IARU. The call sign BY1PK is now held by the Chinese Radio Sports Association, CRSA. Government regulation of radio in China is done by the Bureau of Radio Regulation of the Ministry of Industry and Information Technology, the State Radio Office, according to the State Radio Regulations of China, SRRC. This is the equivalent of our FCC, and like the FCC, The SRRC is a sprawling bureaucracy that handles everything from management of radio spectrum, coordinate efforts of military and civil radio management affairs, deal with radio monitoring, testing, radio interference investigations, coordinate efforts to handle the matters related to electromagnetic interference, maintain the order of the airwaves, organize and implement radio control in accordance with the law, address foreign affairs related with radio regulation, among other matters. There are 7 divisions below the SRRC, including the State Radio Monitoring Center, the State Radio Spectrum Management Center, which is a specialized technical agency for the State Radio Regulation of China. It is in charge of radio monitoring and radio spectrum management, with 14 divisions, 9 state monitoring stations, and 2 subordinate agencies with a staff of over 300. The agency has sweeping duties, which include daily shortwave satellite radio monitoring, to monitor shortwave satellite frequency, satellite orbit resources, find unapproved radio stations, block the illegal radio transmitting through technical measures in accordance with the relevant requirements and regulation. Today, the IARU lists Chinese Radio Amateurs Club, CARC, as China's representative organization at IARU. According to a CRAC report to IARU from October 2015, updated on their website as of January 2024, there are currently 3 classes of amateur license in China, valid for a term of 5 years. Class A, amateur service bands within 30 to 3,000 megahertz with 25 watts maximum output. Class B, maximum 100 watts for bands up to 30 megahertz, 1 watt EIRP for 135.7 to 137.8 kilohertz, 15 watts, 5,351.5 to 5,366.5 kilohertz, 25 watts for bands higher than 30 megahertz. Class C, amateur service or amateur satellite service bands. Maximum 1 kilowatt for bands up to 30 megahertz, 1 watt for 135.7 to 137.8 kilohertz, 15 watts, 5,351.5 to 5,366.5 kilohertz, 25 watts for bands higher than 30 megahertz. It's never been easy to determine the number of licensed amateur operators in China. In the 2015 IARU report, CRAC believed the number to be about 60,000. The ARRL reported that China had more than 174,000 licensees in 2021. According to CRAC, amateurs from other nations may apply for the class of Amateur Radio Operator's Certificate for Visitors, approximate to the home license, but no higher than Class B. The valid duration is 6 months. CRAC posts the approved visitor operation license list on the homepage, which indicates that in the last 9 years since 2015, 133 visitor certificates have been approved. Since the 2015 CRAC report to IARU, China has done a lot to relax its amateur radio rules. There is a 2-part license, a certificate issued to the qualified by examination amateur, and a station license issued to the station's owner, who must be a certified operator. There is no age limit for the qualified amateur, but 18 is the minimum age for station ownership. An applicant for an amateur station license may declare if mobile operation is desired. Type-approved equipment made exclusively for amateur operation can be used, as well as do-it-yourself, assembled and modified transmitting equipment. The new requirements also bring a lot of convenience to the radio amateurs who use these non-type-approved rigs, according to the CRAC website. And now Amateur Radio Insights by Kirk Kleinschmidt, NT0Z. NT0Z at stealthamateur.com. Can JS-8 call take the sting out of K1JT's deadly legacy? 6 years ago to the day, I wrote the most provocative column of my 35-year career as an amateur radio columnist. It was cheeky, insinuative, and irreverent, but with the clarity afforded only by hindsight. I still stand behind it, now perhaps more than ever. As you can see by the title of this month's column, I'm at it again. Titled, Did Joe Taylor, K1JT, Destroy Amateur Radio? The piece was an irreverent and somewhat curmudgeonly take on the meteoric adoption of FT8, now properly called FTXX, because of inevitable splintering, and its detrimental effects, my opinion, but one obviously shared by many, on amateur radio as a whole. If you don't have access to a copy of the February 2018 edition of the Spectrum Monitor, just do a web search for NT0Z K1JT. And the first result from EI5DI.com will pop up. The piece was reprinted with permission in some 15 radio publications from Japan to South America to Europe. So for the record, did K1JT, Nobel laureate and friend to all mankind, destroy amateur radio? Of course he did. As detailed in the original column, 2017, in the depths of the solar cycle doldrums, marked a powerful inflection point in amateur operating practices that persists to this day, despite a much more cooperative ionosphere. Did Professor Taylor destroy amateur radio on purpose? Certainly not. But even an accidental gunshot can kill. And the chain of causality unleashed by the overwhelming adoption of FTXX-style operating, requiring no human participation and the exchange of almost nothing informationally, and several concurrent perfect storm cofactors, will certainly have far-reaching effects. Make no mistake, ham radio is no longer what it was. It can only be as it is. Why, Eckhart Tolle, why? For many veteran hams, what ham radio was before 2017, perhaps before 2004 or so, when a period of two consecutive dud solar cycles were inflicted on us back to back, was more enjoyable and rewarding. So if we want to steer our hobby toward a kinder, gentler future, even in the modern digital age, we have to consider where we were and what happened to get us to where we are now. FTXX, of course, is merely a collection of digital operating protocols. And if we're lucky, those protocols can be tweaked in a way that adds a bit of humanity, wonder, exploration, discovery, excitement, and personal accomplishment back into what has become a dreary, computerized morass of hollowed-out remembrances. Yes, I'm laying it on pretty heavy here for effect. All of my columns are based on my experiences and opinions, of course, but this column is more intense than usual. I rewrote it several times and removed a bunch of stuff that even I came to think of as excessive. You may share my sentiments or you may not. Either way, I hope this column sparks a conversation or two. And as always, feel free to let me know. Later in this column, I will detail my experiences with just such a tweak. JS-8 call software running atop a tweaked set of FT8 protocols called JS-8, which allows, drumroll please, hams to actually communicate in real time, keyboard to keyboard, all the while taking advantage of the incredible signal-to-noise performance gains afforded by a digital protocol originally designed to squirt tiny amounts of data from space probes just now transiting between the edges of our solar system and deep space itself. But before we examine JS-8, let's look at history and cofactors, some of which may turn out to be relevant, some not. Perhaps only future ham radio historians will know how it all turned out. Home Alone? For me, from 1977 until 2017, 40 good years, I knew that I could always turn on a radio and scan up and down the band to see what's what. DX stations would be rocking and rolling on the first 15 kilohertz of the CW subbands, with rag chewers and more casual ops a bit higher in the band. Digital ops could be found between 70 and 100 kilohertz up from the bottom band edge, wailing and warbling to each other on discrete frequencies. Beginners, and those helping the beginners, could often be found from 100 kilohertz to 200 kilohertz up, especially on 15 and 10 meters, which were packed with signals. Although similarly packed with QSOs, I didn't pay nearly as much attention to the SSB subbands, because I was often running QRP and wanted to maximize the reach of my tiny low-power signals. Although I didn't know exactly why at the time, my first exposure to the FT-XX Ageddon was during the 2017 summer eSkip season on 6 and 2 meters. The two previous years saw plenty of SSB and CW QSOs, with a nice increase in the typical number of non-contest CW QSOs. I was working on my VUCC totals and things were looking up. In 2017, however, traditional activity simply fell off a cliff. There was nobody home. I didn't know it at the time, but everyone was FTXXing when I wasn't paying attention. The lack of SSB and CW signals wasn't simply noticeable, it was incredible. In a panic, I went looking for PSK-31 signals, as I had been away from that mode for quite some time, but there were none to be found. Today, still essentially none, but a few can be found on occasion, and there are some specific contests and activities that bring a few warblers to the HF bands. For updated resources, do a web search for the PODXS070 Club, which is an active and friendly group of Digimode communicators. And yes, it's pronounced Podix. The same goes for other keyboard-to-keyboard modes such as traditional RTTY, Throb, Contestia, Olivia, etc. They're out there, but you really have to go looking for them compared to the pre-2017 era. Today, some 6 years after the FT8 Armageddon, if I take a spin up from the bottom of the CW subbands on a non-contest day, the bands often appear completely dead. Until I reach the FTXX watering hole, that is, which is often wall-to-wall with signals, indicating that the band is quite open but nobody's home. Sure, on holidays and at other times a few or even quite a few QSOs might be evident, but it's no longer the norm. It's like being in the twilight zone for hams who were accustomed to the way that the bands used to sound. In 2017 and 2018, columnists in CQ and QST began detailing the magnitude of the paradigm shift, nervously making note of the explosive growth of FT8 QSOs and the commensurate decline of just about everything else. Today, most commentators have moved firmly into the new digital era, leaving only a few boomers such as myself to lament about what we've lost as a hobby, in addition to hopefully praising what we've gained. Unlike previous paradigm shifts, sometimes other ops will challenge my personal sentiments about the present paradigm shift by equating it with previous occurrences. But I have a hard time seeing too many similarities. When Spark gave way to conventionally generated RF, Morse was still Morse. When AM gave way to SSB, the voice comms were still voice comms. When FSK was largely replaced by AFSK, RTTY was still RTTY. When LC-VFOs saw the rise of PLL and then DDS frequency generation, a tuning knob was still a tuning knob, even if it was now a PC mouse. When a single, all-encompassing license class gave way to multi-class incentive licensing, a ticket was still a ticket. The shift to FTXX is not like any of these, as there essentially is no communication whatsoever between hams with FTXX-style operations. Doubling down on dumbing down. I'm sure there are other modern changes that make the present paradigm shift different. We're discussing FTXX, but while we're at it, let's also consider the potential influence of no-code licensing and the switch from FCC testing to VEC testing, which happened way back in the 80s and early 90s. I can't guarantee that either of these changes has had a direct effect on the present paradigm shift, but I'd bet you at chicken dinner they did. My spidey senses are tingling. Note that I'm not suggesting that Morse code was a desirable gatekeeping element for radio hobbyists, but, right or wrong, it kept the merely interested separate from the true believers, who are at least the truly motivated. Very few people casually became hams by tackling Morse just for fun. Did the Morse requirement keep some true believers from becoming hams? Absolutely. And that was truly unfortunate. The ability to parse an inconsistent, time-variable digital code based on audio tone duration is not a universal skill. Studying for and taking tests at the FCC field office was another huge filtering element. Before the VEC era, test questions and answers weren't widely published outside of a few clandestine efforts. If you wanted a ticket beyond novice class, which still had a minimal Morse proficiency requirement, you had to learn, study, and demonstrate significant effort. Plus, doing it all at the FCC field office was suitably scary. In that era, almost without exception, if you were a ham, you had radio fever, an interest in and a love for radio itself, because without having at least a moderate infection, you wouldn't put forth the effort required to get licensed. Whether in sports, love, or business, people value things that cost a lot of time, effort, and or money. Without these, most things are simply not valued. Let's be clear, I'm not disparaging the hams who got licensed after 1991. Amateur radio still values all earnest seekers of radio truth. My focus is on a system that now requires very little knowledge or experience to become licensed. For example, I helped a friend who was really into TVDXing get his general class ticket with about 2 hours of expert tutelage, mine, and a few hours of reading the night before, his. He passed his tests without ever seeing a ham radio up close, and without ever holding a mic or touching a paddle. He's no longer active and never made even a single QSO, which makes sense because he doesn't have radio fever. It's not a crime. He's into stuff that incorporates radio in the periphery, so his increased understanding of radio has benefits outside the hobby, as does the street cred of having a ham ticket at work. No harm, no foul, but also no radio fever. These changes in amateur radio licensing seem to mirror changes in the American educational system as a whole. As a country, we used to score quite well in international comparisons. Now we're 49th or 59th in the world, perhaps because our educational systems mostly reduce everything to the lowest common denominator, dumbing down, to make everything equal for all participants. Is that working out? Not overall, but there are undoubtedly some bright spots. This is where we are as a society, and amateur radio is no exception. And with that fact comes the good and the bad. We'll continue this article next time. Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio. My name is Keith.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.